3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Five, four, three, two, one.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
Welcome to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Study for the Society of Labour History Conference. My name's Ian McIntyre, and you're listening to Community Radio 3CR. Today's program begins with a talk from Philip Deary, who is an Emeritus Professor of History at Victoria University, where he was Director of Research and Research Training in the College of Arts. His talk concerns transnational activism in response to the arrest and execution of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in the United States in the early 1950s, based on allegations of their spying for the Soviet Union.
Charged with conspiracy to commit espionage, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were arrested by the FBI in the summer of 1950 and sentenced to death in the spring of 1951. They are the only Americans ever to receive a death sentence for spying. The widely held view then and now was that the Rosenbergs, or at least Julius, were atom bomb spies who provided the Kremlin with the secret of the atom bomb and thereby committed, in the words of J. Edgar Hoover, the crime of the century. Defenders of the Rosenbergs maintained that their sentences resulted from a flagrant miscarriage of justice and that their deaths constituted legal murder. Before the executions, however, outrage at the death sentence was mobilised and the case elevated into an international cause célèbre of the Cold War. This was primarily due to the efforts of a small committee. It's got a long name, but I'll abbreviate it. The National Committee to Secure Justice in the Case of the Rosenbergs. I'll simply call it the committee. It's difficult for... So this paper very briefly examines that committee, its genesis, the extent of communist domination, and its activation of international solidarity. The committee was formed in October 1951. It was tiny. They met in the New York apartment of David and Emily Allman every Wednesday, and it was bereft of funds. David, who was a 32-year-old novelist, was the executive secretary. David Allman, who turned 100 this year, he's still alive, and when I'd write to him at night time, I would receive the most fluent, beautifully laid out answer the next morning. Remarkable man. He'd been a communist in his youth, but left the party during the Nazi-Soviet pact period. His wife, Emily, a 29-year-old social worker, had never been a party member, but she was the committee secretary. The executive committee was entirely Jewish, and I say this for a point, only one was a member of the Communist Party. The committee's assets consisted of $100, a borrowed mimeograph machine, and a single copy of the trial record. It had no office, no telephone, and, to quote David Allman, no certainty that the general public would respond sympathetically to us. From late 1951, the committee began addressing small meetings in hotels and community halls across America under the heading or the rubric, "Is this the American Dreyfus case?" Now, I probably don't need to tell anyone in this room that Alfred Dreyfus was a Jewish officer convicted of espionage in France in 1899, sentenced to life imprisonment, and eventually exonerated. The Dreyfus case still has resonances in France today. It's the committee's first major effort to mobilise opinion was a public meeting in March 1952 in Manhattan. Over 1,500 New Yorkers paid 60 cents to hear the truth about the Rosenberg case. The meeting lasted 3.5 hours, was addressed by 8 speakers, and a personal death house letter from Ethel was read out. the substantial sum of $5,000 was raised. The success of this meeting energised the Rosenberg Committee and the Ullmans. It found an office, employed a full-time secretary, opened a bank account and issued further appeals. By April 1952, scores of local committees were established, not just in New York, but across the country. And the protest movement began. There were pickets, vigils, rallies, and demonstrations. I'm making the point here that they grow in momentum and gather strength. Hundreds of thousands of pamphlets were distributed, but the National Committee remained chronically short of funds. There was no Moscow gold. But if there were no Moscow gold, was the committee a communist front organisation? Now, this is an important question, because if communist inspired, then the worldwide protest movement can be seen as manipulated by Moscow in order to further the foreign policy goals of the Soviet Union. But if the role of Moscow were negligible and that of the Communist parties limited, then we must see this Cold War protest movement in a different light, and it's one that I'll return to at the end of the paper. Both mainstream and conservative opinion within the United States and much of the literature certainly emphasise communist manipulation or control of the committee. This was even in the early struggling months of its existence. Yet there's extensive evidence of Communist Party indifference, even outright opposition to the committee. In fact, the party sought to undermine the committee and its clemency campaign. First it tried to thwart it, and then it boycotted it. This lasted for more than a year. Emily Orman was visited by a party leader who warned her, quote, not to do the Rosenberg thing. It was a strong-arm tactic. And this is what Dave Orman told me about this issue, and the archival records strongly support his recollection. As for the role of the CP in the fall of 1951, when our committee was formed, the CP did its best to abort it. After boycotting the clemency campaign for over a year, the CP discovered that our little committee of 12 ordinary men and women had by then obtained over 1 million signatures for a new trial or clemency. So in the winter of 1952, when it became apparent to the CP leaders that the rank-and-file communist was visibly supportive of our little committee, and some European countries, especially France and Italy, were sprouting large-scale Rosenberg protests, the CP leadership then decided to participate. So the Rosenberg Committee, therefore, was neither conceived nor controlled by the American Communist Party. Just as it was not controlled by the party, the global protest movement was not orchestrated by Moscow. As Orman suggested, it was only after the protest movement began in Europe and after the Slansky trials in Prague, which I'll return to, that the official communist position changed. In the two-year period between the launching of legal appeals against the Rosenbergs' conviction and sentence and the date of their execution, a protest movement to save the Rosenbergs spread throughout the world. Of all the European countries that witnessed widespread protest against the Rosenberg sentence, France was by far the loudest and most sustained. The Rosenberg Committee forged a link with a non-communist left newspaper, Le Combat. Soon after a French branch was formed, protests intensified and public opinion was mobilised. Among the French press, both moderate and radical, there was an unusual unanimity in their outright condemnation of the death sentence. The mainstream press readily published letters and statements from the local committee questioning judicial procedure of the trial, the unprecedented death sentence, and the stark contrast with a far more lenient sentence given to the British atomic spy, Klaus Fuchs, for a far more serious case of espionage. After Eisenhower denied clemency, the French committee escalated protests. Anti-American sentiments became widespread, even amongst die-hard anti-communists. I won't go into the details here. In the weeks before the executions, dissent in France exploded. Petitions flooded into the US ambassador's office, a day of action, as it was called, was declared, and picketing of the US embassy intensified. In the hours before the executions, tens of thousands of Parisians assembled in La Place de la Concorde. Emotions erupted into violence. The police fired live bullets into the crowd, and 400 were arrested before order was restored and the demonstrators were dispersed. The scale and intensity of the French pro-clemency movement was not matched in Australia. But the fact that a protest movement existed in Australia was indicative of the long reach of the fraternal handshake that embraced those on the left. The Australian campaign to pressure the Truman and Eisenhower administrations to grant clemency to the Rosenbergs had distinctive features, but broadly echoed the American and European approaches: petitions, pickets, meetings, deputations, and vigils. And as in the United States, the Communist Party of Australia became involved in December 1952, but like it, was neither the instigator nor the main perpetuator. In early January 1952, David Allman wrote to a civil liberties group in Sydney appealing for help. This trans-Pacific letter initiated a remarkable episode of international cooperation by two previously unconnected organisations on the left. Allman enclosed pamphlets and printed material and pleaded, "We beg of you in the name of justice and freedom and righteousness and peace to organise actions on behalf of the Rosenbergs." Numerous Save the Rosenberg committees began to form. I've examined their extensive correspondence to Truman, to the Rosenbergs' lawyer and sons, and to the Allmans, and I could not discern the hidden hand of the CPA behind this correspondence. None of it appears orchestrated or standardised, and the timing and the tone of the suggest that the writers were acting independently, spontaneously and viscerally to what they believed was a miscarriage of justice. Indeed, to characterise the clemency campaign in Australia as a front activity for the Communist Party not only disparages the agency of these people, it also overlooks the broad ecumenical support the campaign received from Australia's most senior clergy from every denomination. And most of these church leaders were nobody's dupes. It was not, in fact, for another 11 critical months that the CPA, like the American Communist Party, immersed itself in the Rosenberg case. In December 1952, the Tribune publicised the Rosenberg case for the first time. It analysed the prosecutorial and judicial misconduct at the trial, likened their fate to that of Sacco and Vanzetti, and alleged that, quote, a lowering cloud of anti-Semitism covered the Rosenberg case. Now, the issue of anti-Semitism did punctuate the Rosenberg case, so I'll just refer very briefly to one aspect, the anti-Semitic Slansky trial in Czechoslovakia. There's ample evidence to suggest that the coincidence in timing between sudden communist interest in the Rosenberg case and the treason trial of Rudolf Slansky and 13 other leaders of the Czechoslovak Communist Party was not accidental. In other words, condemning the Rosenberg sentences was a means of deflecting and blunting outrage in the West over the Slansky sentences. Such sudden interest in the Rosenberg case was stimulated and coordinated by communist parties across both Western and Eastern Europe from late 1952. Just 6 days after the Prague executions, the French Communist Party leader, Jacques Duclos, with Stalin's imprimatur, connected the Rosenberg trial in the United States with the Slansky trial in Czechoslovakia. His widely publicised comment read, "The conviction of US atom spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg was an example of anti-Semitism, but the execution of 8 Jews in Czechoslovakia was not. The Australian Communist press, which previously had not drawn any parallel between these two disconnected and dissimilar cases, soon followed suit." Throughout the first 6 months of 1953, the campaign in Australia escalated. The records of the New York Committee bulge with innumerable private letters, petitions, cables and protest resolutions sent from Australia to the United States. As the date of the executions drew closer, so the exchange of correspondence, which exemplifies this trans-Pacific solidarity, between the Australian and American committees increased in volume and in frequency, with the Supreme Court's fourth and final rejection of an 11-hour appeal, the executions now seemed certain to proceed. In the early hours of 17th of June 1953, a vigil commenced in a Sydney park. It was to last 70 hours until their deaths. And actually, this was filmed by, not the Waterside Workers Film Unit, but by another independent left-wing group, and that I found that in the ACO files. In conclusion, irrespective of the efficacy of their efforts, the range of Rosenberg committees in Australia, in Europe and in America were a remarkable emblem of resistance. They resisted the dominant consensus that held that a fair trial had been conducted, that both Rosenbergs were guilty as charged, and that as traitors they deserved to die. None of these charges was true, so the committees disputed these untruths. Finally, the all-important New York Committee. Allman identified up to five different groups of supporters, only one of which was communist, each with their own priorities and objectives, but united by a passionate belief in the injustice of the Rosenberg's sentences. So it was diverse in aim and composition. It was an open, inclusive organisation. It was neither sectarian nor hierarchical. Unlike many Communist Party front organisations, it was democratic without the centralism. The Allmans would have it no other way. That their committee could reach across the Atlantic and the Pacific and trigger the formation of a network of local committees is a profound tribute to the potential of global mobilisation outside the Cold War straitjacket of the 1950s. Thank you.
You're listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. The next talk on today's show is from Vashti Fox, who is an anti-fascist activist currently enrolled in a PhD at the University of Western Australia. Her work concerns anti-fascism in Australia from the 1970s onwards, and this paper focuses on activism in Melbourne during the 1990s directed against the fascist group National Action.
Well, there was a few different kind of impetuses for me to begin doing this research. One is the fact that I've been involved in anti-fascist activism in Melbourne over the last 5 or 6 years since the resurgence of a number of the kind of far-right street movements that have emerged there. The second is obviously the kind of global resurgence of far-right, neo-Nazi and fascist movements. And the third is the fact that I've just enrolled in a PhD here at University of Western Australia, and so all of these kind of different factors coming together prompted, both this paper and, piqued a series of kind of broader investigations. So my PhD is intending to kind of cover from the 1970s onwards, but today I'm just going to focus on the 1990s. It's really interesting in kind of looking at a bunch of the literature that there's been quite a bit written about the histories of the far right, but very little about anti-fascist responses, with the exception of some mass movements and the way that they emerged in the 1930s and the intersections with the kind of labour movement. But in the post-war period, really very little has been written. And so the paper that was just being published in the Labour History Journal focuses on the 1990s. I conducted a series of interviews with activists who were involved at the time, and then also got access to a bunch of very dusty kind of files that people handed over to me that they had had kind of in the bottom of their suitcases or wardrobes or wherever they kind of kept all of these old leaflets and things. And then also kind of looking at a bunch of the far-left publications of the day, again, kind of more dusty than not. So, that's the kind of context, I suppose. So in the closing months of 1993 and at the dawning of 1994, there'd been a series of very violent attacks by fascists and their sympathisers across Melbourne. Their targets included Asian hotel workers, the left, non-white tram conductors and members of the Jewish community. And interestingly enough, there was a series of attacks by fascists on people who were going to see Schindler's List, the film, in particularly in Elsternwick and kind of around there, which is a Jewish mainly suburb of Melbourne. One of the main organisations that was associated with this kind of violence was called National Action. National Action was formed in 1982 by a Brisbane man called James Salim. People who are from New South Wales might know that he's very consistently kind of run, in elections. He ran again, I think, up in Queensland just in the last election, and there was some conflict with Pauline Hanson. And despite the fact that he's kind of claimed that he is not a Nazi, you can see pretty clearly right here where his genuine, where his heart burns. He'd actually been a member of the National Socialist Movement of Australia. Over time, National Action, he'd attempted to kind of reform and reformulate, thinking that after the legacy of the Second World War, that it was impossible to have a genuine, open National Socialist organisation in Australia that could, parade around in this way. And so he attempted to refashion and reshape National Action for changed circumstances. Similarly, National Action kind of changed the targets of their own racism. They were very much an organisation fuelled by anti-immigrant racism, fuelled by racism towards Indigenous people and others, but by the 1990s they overwhelmingly focused their ire on Asian migration and Asian population who had lived here for a long time. So in 1993, they kind of attempted to make a break into Melbourne, and it was something of a black hole for National Action and for various kind of more organised neo-fascist or far-right organisations at this time. And to make a splash, they decided to call a counter-mobilisation, a demonstration, against the Sydney Road Multicultural Festival. So this is quite a bold move. The Sydney Road Multicultural Festival has thousands and thousands of people, floats and so forth, kind of coming out, and they decided that they would, organise something to reassert their desire for a white Australia in this context. This kind of provocation prompted the formation of a group called Brunswick Against the Nazis. And this group set about organising a counter-protest. They attempted to mobilise as many broader forces, trade unions and community organisations as they could, and they had some success. While some more mainstream organisations were a bit more cautious, the more official institutions of the Labor Party and also of the local council, nonetheless, there were a series of kind of, organisations that came on board. But a fortnight before the event, the National Action decided to postpone their rally by a week. And activists were really elated because they felt like the Nazis had already been forced back. And the day itself brought more success for the anti-fascists, as thousands of people appeared to participate in the anti-fascist demonstration, while actually only a tiny number of National Action members revealed themselves. One of the people that I interviewed, a socialist activist called Jerem Small, recalls that there was 10, maybe a dozen, maybe 8 of them all crowded onto a little plinth on Sydney Road in front of the town hall. Michael Brander, who was the new National Action leader, because Jim Salim by this stage was in prison for attempting to assassinate Eddie Funder, who was the representative of the African National Congress in Australia during the time, he said Michael Brander was there with a megaphone. He was accompanied by, and this is Jerem talking again, a bunch of actual skinheads. They looked the part, with braces and shaved heads and boots, with their Eureka flag shouting, "Rights for whites! Rights for whites." It was Nazi fuckwits from Central Casting. The police attempted to separate the two organisations, and they used trams to blockade the anti-fascists and attempted to corral them onto the other side of the street. Then, according to Jerem Small, representatives of one of the student Jewish groups started to arrive. He said, they were the ones that started buying eggs from the local stores. They sent sorties down to Berkeley Square to buy up every single egg from Woolworths and to cart them up. And according to an anarchist, Lee Kendall, a Vietnamese baker also did their bit for the anti-fascist cause by providing several cartons of rotten eggs, so he upped the ante. In a very famous and much touted incident, then someone with excellent fielding skills managed to slot one right into Michael Brander's open mouth, who was shouting at the time. And the whole incident was captured on the evening news. And that little moment is talked about over and over and over again in all of the interviews, and basically anyone who, you know, was there or possibly wasn't there, you know, talks a lot about it. So the battle for Brunswick, as it came to be known, basically concluded after the police tried to usher National Action members through the trams and away to the closest train station. The anti-Nazi rally pursued them, and Small again said, we of course gave chase, with no one really thinking what on earth would we do if we actually caught them. So Small reminisced that the cops got them onto a city-bound train, but they left with their tails between their legs, and we felt like we had a real victory. The anti-fascist activists in Bern drew a number of political conclusions from the Battle of Brunswick. The main one being that direct action, the physical mass confrontation by anti-fascists of the Nazis, was a vital feature of any anti-fascist organising into the future. So to move on to the kind of second incident in Melbourne, John Howard was elected in 1996. You can make him a blue juice at this point, and Pauline Hanson made a splash, and it was into this changed political context that National Action attempted to make its second major foray into Melbourne. And this time, really kind of encouraged by a change in the right's fortunes on a national and a federal level, they rented a former butcher's shop in the economically depressed working class suburb of Fawkner. They opened a bookstore, come clubhouse, and the National Action leader, Michael Brander, moved into the actual bookshop himself. Weeks after the bookshop opened in early 1997, a new opposition group was formed, which really echoed many of the ways in which the Brunswick Against the Nazis had developed. Indeed, many of the individuals and organisations who had been active in Bern came together for a second time to form what subsequently became the Campaign Against the Nazis. By February, CAN had decided to call a protest outside of the bookshop, and they settled on the 15th of March. Like the Brunswick rally, the prospect of this demonstration generated quite a bit of opposition from many of the moderate political forces. So, for instance, the Moreland City Council Mayor Mike Hill and other local councillors argued that protesting National Action would just give them publicity. And again, these are very familiar arguments to anyone who's been involved in anti-fascist organising in the last number of years. Focusing on them, calling them out, organising counter-protests and the like, merely kind of elevates the status of these forces. Fleur Taylor, who was one of the representatives of the Melbourne Uni Student Union at the time, remembered that this was a very widespread response from the political and media establishment. She said, they just wanted attention, so in giving them more attention, you're helping them. But the campaign responded by issuing a series of leaflets. They said, don't ignore the right, fight the fascists, close them down, implored one. Another argued that paying attention to the menace and being alert and alarmed was actually vitally necessary. National Action, the campaign claimed, was a serious physical threat to the local population, and the brutality of historic fascist regimes was invoked. So the catch cry, which a lot of the activists kind of used at the time, was stop them before they grow. Another very significant question occupied the minds of members of CAN, and this was around the question of organising locals in Fawkner. Thousands of houses in the suburb were letterboxed, and a public meeting was called in the area to try and raise awareness about the presence of National Action, because activists were very concerned that in this economically depressed area that the fascists could potentially try and mobilise and grow and get some support. And a number of participants recall that after this meeting occurred, they were very disappointed by the low participation of residents of Fawkner itself. And at the start of the 15th of March demonstration, the question of relating to Fawkner residents really dominated the debate. So all the anti-fascist activists, around 700 of them, gathered in a park near the train station, and they spent about an hour or so debating whether or not they should march straight up to the Tyson Street bookshop, or they should walk through the streets of Fawkner, which was quite deserted at this point, kind of raising awareness. Paul, who was an anarchist activist at the time, was very hostile to what he called the long march through Fawkner. He recalled how Socialist Alternative, Black Bloc anarchists, class war anarchists, and the Australian Syndicalist Federation all argued to go straight to the bookshop because we wanted to catch the Nazis off guard. We thought that it was counterproductive to march all around the streets trying to draw in a crowd when our aim is to drive out the fascists. But we were outvoted by what I would call popular frontists. In the end, we marched around the streets. We didn't get to draw that many people into our crowd, but we drew in some. But a bunch of the protesters became impatient, and it allowed the Nazis to prepare for us. But by the time the march got to the bookshop, the police surrounded the area and erected barricades in front of the shop. And according to Jeff Sparrow, who was a socialist activist at the time as well, he said, we didn't get within a cooey of the place. While Brander remained inside the shop, the rest of the National Action members positioned themselves on the roof. They were dressed as clowns, and they were blasting loud circus music. I suppose they were trying to make a joke of us, according to Paul, but we weren't intimidated. According to Jerome Small, he says, it was quite surreal. The police were on the roof with these literal clowns filming the anti-fascist protest below. So the kind of protest ended. But through that, there was a few further lines of political demarcation that were drawn and that developed. So differences over the question of direct confrontation and violence were also really important at this time. And here, different tendencies on the far left drew from both international and historical trends to bolster their arguments. So one wing of the far left of the campaign, some anarchists and some Trotskyist groups, emphasised the importance of denying the Nazis space. And this tactical approach was framed as no platforming. And that term, people might be familiar with, appeared first in Britain in the 1970s in the campaign against the National Front there, and became codified in the National Union of Students in 1974 as a key element of broader kind of anti-racist struggles. And again, this is another big debate that is currently kind of being played out, both in the press and also in anti-fascist kind of organising across the world. To what degree is no platforming something that you should do? How does this intersect with the questions of free speech and so on and so forth? Another current in the movement against national action, particularly some anarchist currents, placed more emphasis on individual or small group direct action. Other anarchist strategies involve physical attacks on the fascists and the destructions of their property. And Paul recalls that this squadism, or what he called squadism, at this time amounted to something like, when you see a fascist, acquaint their head with the sidewalk. And that kind of activity was hotly contested in anti-fascist circles. Those who supported such action maintained that fascists only understood the language of force, that groups such as National Action needed to be physically intimidated out of their activity, and while others condemned it as elitist and counterproductive. So over time, these kind of debates became resolved in the campaign against the Nazis, and they settled on public opposition to these kinds of individual, more squadist kind of activities. And in a broadsheet that was produced in November of 1997, one of the articles entitled Your Friends on the Streets outlined their position. They said, CAN does not believe in the use of terrorist-style tactics against National Action. National Action are a political problem that requires a political solution. Individual actions risk alienating local communities and add to the already higher levels of fear in Fawkner and South Salisbury. CAN continued their organising throughout 1997, but as the year wore on, it became clear that National Action was having very little success in Fawkner or the surrounding suburbs, and visitors to the shop were very, very few, And rumours suggested that Brando had actually shut up shop, you know, a while earlier and had shifted back to Adelaide. Anyway, the threat began to seem more and more insignificant, and the anti-fascist mobilisations began to dwindle. So some of the energy mobilised in opposing the Faulkner bookshop shifted to agitating against Pauline Hanson and the bigotry she was seen to represent. So the anti-fascist activists of Cannes, already highly attuned to the kind of interconnections between national action and One Nation, were on high alert. And some of the key organisations involved in Cannes took the spirit of anti-fascist organising from this earlier period into the anti-Hanson protest, and they really began to emphasise direct confrontation and an orientation towards organising locals when they could. So, for instance, her public appearances were dogged in a series of fiery, confrontational demonstrations in November of 1996. And this was kind of followed up by 50,000 protesters who poured onto the streets of Melbourne after the Victorian Trades Hall had backed a call for an anti-racist demonstration. In April of 1997, One Nation was formed and Hanson took her party on the road. The party organised a series of town hall meetings in suburbs and towns across the country, and one of the first attempts outside of Queensland took place in Geelong, in Victoria, which was where many of the activists who'd been involved in these earlier protests kind of, you know, took themselves on the road, went down to Geelong and organised quite a fiery demonstration that ended up shutting down the One Nation meeting that happened there. So I suppose, just to conclude, many of the kind of themes which begin to emerge in some of these campaign groups and mobilisations and demonstrations, they really have a legacy which continues on, not just throughout the 1990s, but I would argue that really have a huge amount of resonance today, not just in Australia, but internationally, where there are increasing, there is an increasing urgency, I would say, to anti-fascist mobilising, but not just to anti-fascist mobilising without a sense of the kind of history, but informed by a sense of what has worked in the past, what hasn't, and with some sense of nuance about the kind of the ways in which many of the activists in the past have kind of debated out these questions.
You're listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. The final speaker for today is Verity Bergman. She's an adjunct professor of political science in the School of Social Sciences at Monash University and an honorary fellow in the East Scholarship Research Centre at the University of Melbourne. She's also the director of the Reason in Revolt Archival Project, which can be checked out at reasoninrevolt.net.au. Her talk explores the role of labour unions in the alter-globalisation movement of the late 1990s and early 2000s.
We should always be wary of prole bashing, as I call it. We don't want to be like Clinton-esque American liberals who say that the election of Trump was the fault of racist workers. But I think it is undeniable that the right-wing populist response to corporate globalisation has greater political traction nowadays than left-wing critiques, despite Syriza and Podemos, Corbyn and Sanders. So how have we got to the point where the dominant media narrative equates anti-globalisation with right-wing nutters? Because less than two decades ago, it was a vibrant left-wing movement that was the voice of anti-globalisation, and it had huge media coverage. The most common descriptions of that movement were anti-capitalism, anti-corporate globalisation, global justice, or simply anti-globalisation. It was renowned for highly effective blockading of the meetings of the World Trade Organisation, World Bank, WEF, etc., the strategy known as summit hopping or summit storming. And that was a movement that demonstrated that critique of neoliberal globalisation was compatible with cosmopolitanism and technological progress, and indeed with internationalism and working class solidarity across national borders. It contested that deceitful dichotomy presented by neoliberal globalisers, where you have either progressive cosmopolitan embrace of the global market, or regressively xenophobic and protectionist nationalism. In fact, the movement insisted we are the real globalists. Unfortunately, over the last 15 years, criticism of neoliberal globalisation has become associated with xenophobia, racism and nationalism, and far-right demagogues have capitalised upon working-class discontent with globalisation to increase their appeal. Now, their support bases are predominantly petty bourgeois, but their electoral viability is assisted by a bleeding of some working-class support away from centre-left parties to these populist right-wing contenders. Not because workers are any more racist than other sections of society, but I would argue because of the de-social democratisation of those centre-left parties, which have alienated traditional working-class supporters, facilitating the rise of right-wing populism. With some exception, those parties have not effectively picked up the discontent generated in a more brutal labour market, politicised it and channeled it into an organised interest-based struggle. So they have pushed workers, some workers, into the arms of the far-right parties, who support all the discontent and do their best to channel people's rage against other victims of neoliberal globalisation, against other social groups, immigrants, Muslims, gay people, people of different colours, etc., rather than against the causes of the problems these people are experiencing. Now, in those debates around de-social democratisation, very little attention has been paid to the behaviour of trade unions. Have trade unions also been too hesitant in articulating the discontents of globalisation and thereby encouraging some workers to express their grievances through reactionary channels? There was a very early groundbreaking study of the anti-globalisation movement by Amory Starr, who argued at the time, around the turn of the millennium, that the labour movement was positioned as the natural leader of globalisation from below. So in this paper I'm asking, where was the union movement in this anti-corporate movement? Did it participate in the blockading of the citadels of corporate global power? I'm looking briefly at four case studies. Principally the Battle of Seattle and the mobilisations in Melbourne, Quebec City and Genoa, with emphasis on eyewitnesses, on testimony from people present or people who I interviewed afterwards. So firstly, the Battle of Seattle. All commentators agree that organised unionists were the majority of the Seattle protesters, 30,000 of the 50,000. The remaining 20,000 were from environmental and other movements. On the very first day, 10,000 dock workers of the Longshoremen's Union shut down every port on the West Coast. Hundreds of Seattle port workers spent that work-free day blockading the doors of the World Trade Organization's conference centre. There was a massive labour rally and march sponsored by the AFL-CIO, which was the highlight of the first day, and Doug Henwood describes the scene enthusiastically. A lot of upbeat commentary about the kind of unity across movements that was displayed with Labour at the forefront. But other observers provide more nuanced accounts. Jeff Sinclair emphasises that rank-and-file unionists were angry with the moderation of their own officials, that Labour's legions were supposed to march from the Space Needle to the Convention Centre and prevent the WTO delegates from assembling. This was the expectation. But, according to Sinclair and to people I've talked to who were there, this is what happened. The protesters kept asking, where are the Labour marches? You know, they were expecting thousands and thousands of longshoremen and teamsters to reinforce them in the fray. But they didn't arrive. They were steered away by the union officials. Another eyewitness, Chris Carlson, agrees that in spite of the organised monitors attempting to turn the union march away, what happened was that thousands of individual rank-and-file workers poured into the streets in support of the seizure of downtown. So they defied what the union bosses were wanting them to do, stay away. John Charlton also saw AFL-CIO bureaucrats trying to keep the union forces away from the battle zone by detouring the Labour rally, but many rank-and-file militants defying those lieutenants to join the troops downtown. And so, understandably, there was upbeat Labourist commentary in the wake of the Battle of Seattle, which argued this period of growing rebellion was witnessing the revival of the Labour movement that was finally showing signs of attempting to chart a new course. But the behaviour of AFL-CIO officials at the Battle of Seattle suggests optimism was not necessarily justifiable. But certainly what is true is the extent to which working class people were active in the encounter and many union activists crucial to the success of the mobilisation. Now we come to Melbourne, September 2000. And according to the commentators and eyewitnesses, here too the union movement hierarchy prevented full union support of the S11 blockade. According to some, union leaders also ordered unionists not to prevent delegates attending the World Economic Forum meeting. S11 organiser David Glantz stated in an interview that he thought unions were hesitant due to pressure from the state Labor government and the police officers' union, distrust of the far left organising the protest, and concern that the media would use the event to accuse unions of violence. Also in an interview, Victorian Trades and Labour Council Secretary Lee Hubbard was critical of the S11 organisers, complaining that they did not approach the unions for support until after they'd planned the event. So relations were not great from the outset, but nonetheless, unions turned up in large numbers. On the second day, 10,000 unionists marched from Trades Hall to the casino complex. But instead of joining the blockade, the unions staged their own rally alongside the blockade. But again, like in Seattle, after the union rally, lots and lots of individual unionists then joined the blockade. So according to a participant observer, the union contribution to S11 was a balancing act. The march was staged so as to minimise conflict with the police due to police union pressure and the right faction of the Labor Party pressuring leading ACTU officials to oppose S11. So now we move to Canada and to the Quebec City mobilisation in April 2001. And again, ambivalence and hesitation characterise official union involvement. Kevin Mackay talks about the important yet contradictory role that workers play within the current politics of anti-capitalist mobilisation at writing at the time. Mackay argued there was great variation among unions in terms of their participation in anti-capitalist summit storming, but that a more important conflict highlighted was between the executive and rank and file within unions. So in Quebec City, as in Seattle, rank and file unionists opposed the official position of staying away from the centre of action. And Mackay argues that this demonstrates radicalism amongst the union rank and file, but the problems imposed from the more conservative union hierarchy. Now, Labor's big event at Quebec City, the People's March, was directed away from the scene of direct action. That was the 4-kilometre-long concrete and chain-link fence erected round the old city to keep summit delegates protected from the protesters. But many individual unionists, again, they broke away and went to the fence with the rest of the movement, evidence of the divisions within the union movement between the rank-and-file militants and the more conservative union leaders. Union activist Paul Jones wrote, "Where was Labor?" Now, other unionists defended the move away from the fence. They credited the large numbers in the People's March with assurances from the Quebec unions that it would be safe for workers and their families. But Ken Davidson of the Public Employees Union said after the mobilisation, "We can't leave it up to the youth. We have to take it on ourselves. Once our members understand how free trade globalisation affects their jobs, they'll be willing to engage in civil disobedience." In Genoa, now this is often regarded as the high point of anti-corporate mobilisation. It attracted more than 200,000 protesters. But from the outset, there were tensions evident between the moderate Genoa Social Forum that was organising the demonstrations and the radical Italian unionists organised in COBAS. COBAS is a radical syndicalist rank-and-file trade union grouping formed in the late 1980s by unionists dissatisfied with the moderation of the three main Italian union confederations, and it was advocating a new kind of union movement that would really take it up to capitalism. Now, a few days before the summit, the government closed the main Genoa railway station, which made it very, very difficult for the visiting protesters to arrive. The mainstream unions, along with the Genoa Social Forum, condemned this closing of the station, but COBAS announce national strikes to oppose what was going on. Now, at Genoa, there was some very useful research done by Donatella Della Porta and her research team. And she argues that unions around this time were typically riven by divisions between those who wanted to take the fight up to neoliberal globalisation and oppose privatisation and so on, and others who, you know, were supporting deregulation and flexibilisation and all that sort of crap. She argues the 1990s was an important moment amongst European unions in this respect. So finally, what do we know, what can we conclude from the evidence of these episodes? It certainly suggests strong working class involvement, especially of white collar public sector workers, and important contributions from union activists and particular radical unions. Involvement revitalised these unions. However, most trade union hierarchies were ambivalent about or absent from these anti-corporate protests. Officials mostly preferred union contingents keep a safe distance, revealing tensions between militant activists and conservative officials. So was this a lost moment for Labor? Did the hesitant part played by union hierarchies in anti-corporate politics help sow the ground for far-right populist anti-globalisation? Union behaviour certainly confirmed the truism of union movement scholarship. The existence in unionism of the universal tension between the contradictory elements of movement and organisation. Ralph Darlington has drawn attention to the particular problem of trade union bureaucracy, the way that full-time officials have an interest in the continued existence of a system on which their position depends. Obviously, this builds on a lot of previous scholarship by Hyman and others. And so they end up trying to make peace. Usually that leads them to dampen down workers' resistance. Richard Hyman has written extensively about how institutional pressures create within unionism a perpetual ambivalence about winning real improvements for workers, but also controlling them in the interests of employers and governments. But if unions want to counter the drift of angry workers to right-wing populism and also at the same time stem their own decline as organisations, unions need to pay less heed to the organisation and embrace instead the movement inherent within unionism. Hyman argues that to change the world, unions must change themselves. And he goes on to say that the urgent need is to regain an inspiring vision of unions as a sort of justice, which many unions have lost. Unions have to articulate a more humane, more solidaristic, and more plausible alternative if they are to vanquish neoliberalism. They need to find new ways to express their traditional core principles and values and to appeal to a modern generation for whom old slogans have little meaning. And he says, and since defending the weak is inescapably a question of power, unions have to help construct a new type of politics, in particular by engaging with campaigning and protest movements in ways which most trade unions have failed to do. And I would add to that, and certainly which they did not wholeheartedly do in the case of the great anti-corporate globalisation movement. And I think that was a lost moment for the industrial wing of the labour movement.
Thanks for listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Study for the Society of Labour History Conference. If you'd like to find out more about the Society, its various branches and labour history in general, then please visit labourhistory.org.au. Listen in next week for more talks from the conference.
1, 2, 3, 4... First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you. They're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do and everything can change. So click. businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change so quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change so quick. Everything can change.